In the matter of State versus Wang, may we please have appearances of counsel? Counsel? Appellant?
Joseph Benedict on behalf of James and Wang.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Benedict, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and other members of the Supreme Court. Thank you for this opportunity. I want to say, first of all, just reviewing the colloquy that Judge Payon had with myself.
Could you speak up a little bit?
I will try to. Reviewing the colloquy that Judge Payon had during the motion, the colloquy between myself and the prosecutor, as well as reviewing his decision, it appears to me, and I would hope to this court, that he was fully cognizant of what the facts were in this case, as well as the law. So the issue before this court now is whether or not he abused his discretion when he applied his finding of those facts to the law, as he recited it in his decision. And I suggest to you that the evidence that he saw really supports the conclusion that he reached. The evidence was a videotape, data that came from the vehicle, data recorder, and the testimony of Detective Heck. The video that I have, incidentally, runs at a faster speed, and I don't know whether that happened to any of the members of the Supreme Court, and I understand it has to do from... The prosecutor tells me whatever program you happen to have on your computer, mine only allowed me to see this at a pretty fast pace. And you can tell right away when you look at the pedestrian who's in the beginning of the video, who seems to be speed walking down the street. But what I did was I paused the video late into the 56th second. And I want to tell you what that shows me. It shows Mr. Wang's vehicle having already crossed Raritan Avenue, and he is in what we call the slow lane or the outer lane. From the north, the sole car coming from the north has not yet reached Columbia Avenue, and he's completely across all four lanes of traffic. I look to the south in the video, and no car yet appears coming from the south. And you look at the video, there's got to be at least 12 car lengths before that don't appear in the video. The point of this is that when he's crossing Raritan Avenue, his conduct has no effect on cars going right or left. And I suggest, if you can, stop the video at that point, and you'll see exactly what I'm saying. Late in the 56th second, before he actually strikes the curb, no vehicles coming from the south, the car from the north not even reaching the intersection. So what happens then? According to Detective Heck, and this is his testimony, relied upon by Judge Payon, he wasn't successful making the turn. Another point in his testimony, he said he failed to negotiate a full left turn. So what was the judge left with? He was left with the other testimony of Detective Heck about what the data told him. And the data told him that in the course of 4.65 seconds, moving from a rolling stop at 3 miles an hour to hitting the planter, he achieved a maximum speed of 37 miles per hour. And the judge wanted to know, what about that part suggests recklessness? What about that part tells me that he was aware of a substantial and unjustifiable risk and that he consciously avoided it? The reality is he did hit the curb, he lost control, and with a second later he hits this planter. And I want to note, you know, the appellate division majority made a lot to do about what happened after he hits the planter. And I'm not sure that's relevant at all, because what happens when he hits the planter is the airbag explodes in his face. And they say, well, you know, he didn't hit the brake. Well, from the time that he hits the curb to the time that he hits the planter is virtually a second. So the judge said to the prosecutor, you're trying to tell me that this speed was excessive, this acceleration. Why should I conclude that? What can you tell me that convinces me that that speed in and of itself, how fast he's accelerating? And the prosecutor really had no answer for it. He said, well, you can infer recklessness. And one of the most telling things, I think, about the colloquy with the prosecutor was when the judge says, why didn't your expert address this? Because as you may remember from the grand jury transcript, the first thing the prosecutor did was establish that Detective Heck has had 700 hours of training in accident reconstruction. Yet Heck, who testified for the state, never said anything about that was too fast. So we hear from the prosecutor using terms like he's gunning it. He's rapidly accelerating. The judge says, well, you've got to get out onto a highway or a roadway where the speed limit is 45 miles an hour. What is it about achieving 37 miles per hour in 4.65 seconds that tells me that there's a conscious disregard of an unjustifiable and substantial risk?
Mr. Benedict, yes. Flip it around for us.
Sure.
Are you arguing that one cannot infer recklessness from rapid acceleration of this sort?
I'm sure they could if there were evidence that this was rapid other than the prosecutor's conclusory remarks. I think the judge was fully within his right saying, why didn't your expert testify to that? He said, you know, if your expert said that was too fast, that he was moving too quickly making the turn and he could lose control, that had something to rely on. But for the prosecutor to just mouth these words?
Well, forget about that.
Yes.
Can you infer recklessness from a car mounting a sidewalk? Just that alone. Forget about speed. A car, for purposes of the grand jury, cars are not supposed to be riding on the sidewalks.
Agreed.
Okay, so this one is for a short distance and with fatal consequences is riding on a sidewalk. From that alone, would a grand juror be able to infer recklessness?
I would certainly hope not. The witness for the state described it as being unsuccessful in making the turn. You know, the legislature has defined for us what they mean by reckless and what they mean by negligence. The difference between the failure to perceive and being aware that you're creating an unjustifiable risk. Losing control of a vehicle and making the left turn, in the words of Detective Heck, he wasn't successful in making the turn. I think the state is trying to go too far in converting common negligence into criminal conduct. And I don't know if there's anything more I can say. I think I've...
Add into the mix the information that comes from Calum, if I'm remembering the name correctly.
Well, Calum, you have both statements from Calum. In the very first statement, he does describe that Huang does like the feel of acceleration. And he's asked, you know, how often does that happen? He says maybe one out of three times. And then he is specifically asked, was he going too fast? Did he stomp on, I think the question was, did he stomp on the gas pedal? And he says, no. And the detective says, well, why do you say that? And he says, because it didn't seem like he was going that fast. And then the detective seemingly starts to argue with him. Hey, didn't you tell me he likes this feeling? You know, he had to have gone fast in order to make that turn and lose control. And then he subsequently takes his statement from...
Does the rate of acceleration play any part in this analysis? Not the terminal speed, but the rate at which the car arrived at that speed, the fact that the gas pedal was 75% depressed, that it arrived from zero to that speed and at short distance of time. Does that play into the equation? In other words, when a car's at a stop, you can go to 60 miles an hour, take half a mile, quarter mile to get there, or you can get there in 50, 75 yards if you're drag racing. Does that distance at which a car arrived at that speed play a part in the analysis?
I think it could have, and I think if an expert said that achieving, I mean, let's take a look at the data. He went from 3 miles an hour to 37 miles an hour in 4.65 seconds. There's nothing about that that resonates that says that's an unreasonable.
Wouldn't you need an expert to make the argument you're making? Shouldn't that go to a jury for a jury to decide with an expert, just like you're saying, that doesn't resonate as speeding? We don't know that because we don't have an expert to talk about coefficient of traction, speed of the engine, rate of acceleration with the gas. We do have the depressant of the gas pedal, but shouldn't someone put all that together, and wouldn't that be better before a jury, had a jury in a trial?
That's what Judge Payone felt. The expert was in front of the grand jury. He wanted to know why wasn't he asked that question. Why am I supposed to rely on you telling me that going...
Yeah, but you're making the counter-argument that it doesn't bespeak of rapid acceleration, but we don't know that either because you don't have an expert. There was no expert to say that.
I think the judge applied common sense. I mean, over four and a half seconds to increase your speed by some 30 miles per hour?
Some cars can achieve that speed in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Some cars take 10, 12 seconds to achieve that speed, so we don't know what the acceleration capability of this car was. And shouldn't a full jury decide that during a trial rather than on an indictment?
I disagree. I think that Judge Payone was required to see whether or not there was sufficient evidence in this record to substantiate the claim by the state that this was reckless conduct.
So let me ask you a question about the standard of review. Should the standard of review in determining whether or not there's a prima facie case before the grand jury be de novo as opposed to abuse of discretion? No different than the standard of review that we would apply in a summary judgment matter or whether or not a judgment was properly entered by a court?
Not a question I really was anticipating being asked. I feel very comfortable in relying on what the case law tells me the standard is right now, which is you have to find that Judge Payone abused his discretion.
But it doesn't seem. It might make sense in certain instances, like whether or not there's exculpatory evidence. But when the cold record can be reviewed by this court, just as well as by the trial court, and where there are no fact findings because we're supposed to be looking at the record in the light most favorable to the state, I don't know why this would not be a de novo standard review under this precise circumstance. Can you respond to that?
Well, I think even with a de novo review, this evidence has been looked at by four different judges. Two of them did not feel that it amounted to probable cause. Is that the kind of case you want my client to have to stand a jury trial for with the emotional weight that's going to be thrown against him by the state? This is a horrific accident. You know, the first time they went to the grand jury, they were able to get a grand jury to vote that conduct was knowing, that there was extreme indifference to human life. I don't want to try this case if it's not necessary. Judge Payone called it the right way, and I trust this court will see it that way as well.
Questions, anyone?
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hewlett.
May it please the court. The general principles of law that are before the case today in State versus Wang are very well established. A grand jury is not an adjudicatory body, it's an accusatory body. So therefore, issues of admissibility of evidence are not at play. The grand jury decides whether there's an adequate basis to bring forth a criminal charge. Case law calls it a prima facie case or a probable cause, but it's some evidence that the elements of the offense have been met. And once the grand jury returns an indictment, it's presumed to be valid, and it's only to be dismissed upon the clearest and plainest grounds, meaning palpably defective. And along those lines, the evidence that the state presented to the grand jury is reviewed in the light most favorable to the state. What happened here was the trial court failed to review the state's evidence before the grand jury in its proper light, prejudged the case, determined at the outset this wasn't a case for reckless operation of a motor vehicle, and was just determined to dismiss the indictment. The state thought or hoped that it would get relief from the appellate division because the standard of review for the trial court was abuse of discretion. And the majority in the appellate division reviewed the evidence properly in accordance with the law and found that the state's indictment was supported by a prima facie case. Unfortunately, the dissenting judge in the appellate division made the same misanalysis that the trial court did, found that we hadn't presented enough evidence and that we hadn't even presented evidence of a crime, and went even further to impugn the motivation and integrity of the state in going back to the second grand jury when there was no support whatsoever for such a claim, was not a basis for dismissing the second indictment, and it was never an argument proffered by the defense. The majority opinion correctly applied the law in looking at the state's evidence. And I wanted to point out a factual matter. In the course of the dissent's opinion, the dissenting judge writes that there were no motor vehicle summonses issued. Now, at the oral argument in January of last year, there was a question asked about whether there were a speeding ticket, and the trial prosecutor said no, but there were tickets. There were 5 motor vehicle tickets issued against defendant: reckless driving, careless driving, unsafe operation of a motor vehicle, improper riding on a curb, and unsafe lane change. The unsafe lane change ticket was based on when the defendant turned and crossed the highway, he crossed over the double yellow lines, as opposed to going through the break in the double yellow lines where you're supposed to make your turn. So there were speeding tickets that were mentioned briefly in the oral argument, but there were tickets. And since I also want to close my opening with the speed of the video, when counsel called yesterday and said that your disc plays too fast, if you play it in Windows Media, it plays too fast. The way the trial prosecutor played it for the grand jury was a VLC media player, which plays it in real time. So it depends on which program you use to play it. So that's my opening statement.
At the heart of this case is whether there's sufficient evidence of recklessness viewed in the light you've described. Tell us what the most important piece or pieces of evidence in that regard are.
I say every single piece that we presented was important. I'll start with the surveillance video, number one. Numero uno, it tells you exactly what happened. It shows you how he came out of that strip mall, crossed the highway, and went right up on the curb. He never had control of a car. In 4.65 seconds, he exited from the strip mall, crossed the highway, went up on the curb, was accelerating, never placed his brakes. So that's based on the video that shows you what happened. Two, the page from the data recorder inside the car, which tells you what was going on inside the car at the time that this happened. His rate of acceleration. He went from a low number to almost full throttle, 70%, within less than 5 seconds. And it's not like he's going straight, he's making a turn. So the video, the data recorder evidence, also very important, were the eyewitnesses whose statements were summarized. 3 eyewitnesses saw the defendant come out and said that he was going at a fast rate of speed. You have the statements of his first front seat passenger, who told police how defendant liked the feel of accelerating from a stop position to suddenly going fast and push back in the car. He said that when they left the strip mall to cross the highway, he did feel that sensation.
Isn't that just physics?
Yes, Your Honor. It's common sense.
Well, doesn't that happen every time you put your foot on the accelerator? That you get pushed back on your car?
If you push too fast, no, you don't. I base it on my own personal experience. When I make a turn, I don't go 37 miles an hour in 5 seconds.
Answer my question. You get pushed back when you hit the accelerator. Isn't that just normal driving?
No, Your Honor, no.
Okay.
No, this was not normal driving.
I guess that would all depend on how far you depress the gas pedal. If you do it very gently, you wouldn't get pushed back. The harder you do it.
Well, that was the point I was trying to make. If you don't press so hard on the pedal, you're not going to have that pushback in the seat. In order to get that, you have to push very hard.
How was the evidence that he enjoyed the feeling of speed? How was that presented? Under what rule would that be admissible?
Well, the state submits it would be admissible as maybe habit evidence if it came to an admissibility issue. If it fell under the rubric of 404B, it would come in on the issue of mental state. And the reason why it was probative and important was at the first oral argument, when the trial court was questioning the state, he couldn't understand how the state's theory of recklessness could be based on how he came out of the strip mall. In other words, the argument was, well, he had to come out of there fast because the cars that were coming this way and this way on Route 27 were going at a speed limit of at least 40 miles per hour because that's the speed limit on the highway. But what the state wanted to show was that the reason why he went out so fast was, as we said in layman's parlance, he was gunning the car. And that's why he went out at the angle he did. He didn't leave the parking lot through the break in the double yellow line. He went straight out across the yellow lines because he was trying to beat traffic and he was going too fast. He wanted to beat the cars. And we had evidence from Mr. Vallejo, who was coming northbound, that he had to change lanes in order to avoid defendant's car. So the conscious disregard here were other cars, people on the sidewalk, and the accident and death here show that there are people on the sidewalk, himself and his passenger.
Well, I know that much of our case law says the standard is abuse of discretion, but when the sole task of our court is to determine whether or not there's sufficient evidence presented to the grand jury, is our review de novo?
I would say that your review is whether the appellate division abused its discretion, and yes, it could be de novo review, because it's a question of law.
It seems to me it's no different than the approach we would take in a summary judgment motion or determining on a cold record whether or not a judgment of acquittal was, the NOV was entered. We would look at the evidence in light most favorable to the state. There's no fact-finding. And in that regard, our task is no different than that of the trial court or the appellate division, and no court is in a better position than any other court in looking at the record.
I don't disagree with Your Honor on that, not at all.
So you're saying that we should not review Judge Payone's decision under an abuse of discretion standard?
Well, I'm asking the court to review the majority of the appellate division.
Yeah, I believe Justice Albin is asking why the standard of review of the trial court's decision
of
the evidence.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking about the appellate division.
No.
I'm sorry. The judgment under review here is the appellate division.
Right. But I believe that what you might have just answered as de novo is the question being asked was, what is the standard of review that this court should apply in reviewing the court's review of the evidence for purposes of deciding on whether or not the indictment should be
dismissed? The standard of review is whether the appellate division abused its discretion in holding that there was sufficient evidence presented.
So we're not going in circles. We start off with what would the appellate standard of review be of the trial court. And I'm suggesting that would be de novo. It wouldn't be abuse of discretion. It would be looking at the transcript in the light most favorable to the state and making a decision And then our standard would be the same. This is just the way it works in a, with a summary judgment motion.
Your Honor, the standard before the appellate division when it reviewed the trial court was whether the trial court abused its discretion in dismissing the indictment. And there's case law that the state cited for that proposition.
I know it says that. I'm trying to understand why, when we're just determining the sufficiency of the evidence in a grand jury transcript, why under that circumstance, we would be utilizing an abuse of discretion standard. Why the appellate court would be doing that?
Well, Your Honor, I'm just reciting what the law provides on how you review a dismissal of an indictment once it's been done. And once it's been dismissed, the issue is whether the trial court abused its discretion. So likewise,
so what does that mean? What does that mean? Okay, so if you're going to use abuse of discretion, how do I determine whether or not the appellate division abused its discretion?
Well, you would look at its decision, how it applied the established precedent that I've already outlined, whether it made a clear exercise and a clear mistake.
So we wouldn't look at the facts at all? The facts that you've been presenting, we wouldn't look at them at all. We'd just see with the appellate division reviewing those facts with that our trial de novo review of that, whether they abused its discretion and come into their finding.
Well, when you review the appellate division decision, you have to look at the evidence that it reviewed that we presented to the grand jury. So I don't understand how you couldn't look at the facts or the evidence that was submitted.
You'd go through the same process they would. Just to be clear, the state is not agreeing or a proponent of changing the appellate standard for a dismissal of an indictment such as exists here, from abuse of discretion to de novo. Am I right about that?
The state is not taking that position. No, the state was not seeking that.
And you're arguing that there was an abuse of discretion at the trial court level?
As well as, yes. And that's why we were fortunate to convince the majority in the appellate division that there had been. But unfortunately, the dissenting judge followed the rationale and reasoning of the trial court. And where the abuse of discretion occurred was, as I said in my opening, was the trial court just didn't review the evidence in its proper light. This is a grand jury proceeding. It's just whether there's some evidence to support the state's charges. It's not a trial on the merits. And a lot of the arguments that defendant made below were arguments for trial. We just had to show some evidence supporting our charge. And we clearly did. And all the pieces of evidence that we submitted, the video, the data recorder sheet, the outline of the witness testimony were all very important to show that this was a reckless operation of a motor vehicle. And we clearly set forth, and we presented a different presentation than we did the first time.
So I'm just trying to nail down my mind, the standard. If it's abuse of discretion, should we be paying deference to the trial court, the trial court's decision?
No, before the court is the judgment of the appellate division. That's what's before the court.
Should the appellate division have paid deference to the trial court's decision?
No.
Why not?
Well, the issue was whether or not the trial court properly reviewed the evidence in determining that we hadn't established a prima facie case.
But when you review under an abuse of discretion standard, any time you do that, you are affording some deference to the trial court, correct?
Well, I don't see how there was any deference here. He reviewed the evidence and didn't give it its due weight and found that there was no crime.
I'm sorry. When the appellate division or any appellate court reviews a trial court's determination under an abuse of discretion standard, that does give deference. Now, it doesn't mean that it doesn't get reversed, but it does give some deference to the trial court as a general matter, does it not?
I'm not aware of that being the case, Your Honor. Usually we give deference to fact-finding of a fact-finder. But here the judge was making, as I indicated earlier, he was making a conclusion of law, whether or not there was a prima facie case before the grand jury. He wasn't making findings of fact. He didn't make, the first time around, when the first dismissal, he did make a call that the investigator had misled the grand jury. But with respect to this indictment, there was no credibility call that we had misled the grand jury. So
you're viewing that as a legal issue? Whether or not there was sufficient evidence looking at the evidence supporting the state.
Yes, it's a mixed question of whether the evidence that we submitted supported the standard for obtaining an indictment. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of mixed.
It's a mixed question of law, in fact, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
It's not an issue of law such as the interpretation of a statute or something
along
those lines?
No, it's mixed. It's like the judge reviews the evidence that we presented and then determines whether or not it fit the standard for obtaining an indictment. And when the trial court dismissed the indictment, finding that the state hadn't met a prima facie case, when the state went to the appellate division, it was whether the trial court's decision in that regard was an abuse of discretion, whether it was clearly mistaken. So the state was operating that's the same standard before this court, whether the judgment of the appellate division, which would be the majority opinion, was clearly mistaken, an abuse of discretion, under the established law on how we review the sufficiency of indictments. And the state submits that the majority opinion is the correct opinion, the proper opinion, and the dissenting opinion is not.
Ms. Hewlett, we may have sidetracked you with some questions. You pointed us to the video, the data recorder, the eyewitnesses, and the passenger. Is there anything else?
Yes. I point out the medical records. We submitted all the medical records from the date of the accident and the crash. We also submitted medical evidence that the defense attorney submitted to us that we submitted. And the medical documents from January 16, 2016 don't show that there was some type of neurological or physiological explanation for why this awful accident and crash happened. But we presented it. And in those medical documents, there are statements from the defendant that are inconsistent with what he told our investigator, that when he came out to make the turn, he somehow saw lights and got dizzy. He told the triage nurse that he lost control of his car and that he hit a child and some people. Then there's a medical report where he tells a doctor that he lost control of his car and he was going 37 to 40 miles per hour. So those are consistent with him knowing exactly what was happening. And as the investigator testified before the second grand jury, the fact that he never applied his brakes is very important. That's why the data recorder sheet is very probative, because it tells you what was going on inside the car. So every single piece of evidence that we submitted, it was important because it put together why this was a reckless operation of the car, why we had a prima facie showing that there was a reckless operation of the vehicle that led to a death and serious bodily injury.
Questions? Anything you'd like to add?
Yes, Your Honor. If the court affirms the majority ruling, as the state outlined very in its brief and in its letters, we ask that this case be remanded to a different judge.
Why is that?
The state feels that there is an appearance that we would not get a fair trial. And there would be appearance issues with rulings where this judge twice was very firm in holding that this was nothing more than civil negligence. The state's entitled to a fair trial, and the victims are entitled to the appearance of impartiality from the bench.
Are you suggesting that if it goes back to this court, he would not be impartial?
We think that, no, he would not be impartial.
Is that beyond the scope of the dissent? The appellate division majority did not grant that remedy. The dissent didn't address that remedy. Obviously, we're bound. Our scope of review is limited by the scope of the dissent, and that's purely a question back and forth with respect to the weight of the evidence.
Well, if the court affirms the majority, and of course we feel that it can be before the court because we're simply asking what this court orders for the remand. If it agrees with the majority that this indictment stands and there has to be a remand for trial, the state doesn't see why the court couldn't order that it be before a different judge.
Did you request that relief before the appellate division?
No.
Why not? Why are you requesting that relief before the Supreme Court when you did not make that request before the appellate division?
Well, at the time that we argued in the appellate division, our focus was just on getting the indictment reinstated. And perhaps it was an oversight on our part that we didn't ask for it at that time.
We understand. We understand your position.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Hewlett. Ms. Leonard.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The Attorney General's interest in this case is to preserve the integrity of the grand jury process. The grand jury, an indictment by grand jury, is just the very beginning of the long criminal process. And that's why this court has recognized time and again that it is an accusatory body, not an adjudicative one. And its role is to investigate potential defendants and decide whether a criminal proceeding should commence. But once the grand jury made that decision here, and twice, in fact, the trial judge was duty-bound to give every reasonable inference to the state and only disturb the indictment if it was manifestly deficient or palpably defective. And in making that determination, he was bound to look to see if the state presented some evidence as to each count. And here the issue is, of course, the element of recklessness. The sum evidence that the state presented included the video and the description of the video by the detective here of the defendant pulling out so quickly that he immediately lost control of his car. He, while making a left-hand turn, it was accelerating at with his foot three-quarters of the way down to the floor. And, you know, I'd like to address this fallacy that just because he was entering traffic, he had to do so quickly to safely enter the roadway. He wasn't entering on an entrance ramp onto a highway on a straightaway. This was a left-hand turn. He was sitting in a parking lot. His option was to wait if it wasn't safe to enter the roadway. He didn't have to enter when he did. And entering so quickly such that his back is thrown into the seat, if you slowly accelerate, your back isn't going to be thrown into your seat. And what the defendant's friend mentioned was that he liked that sensation of being thrown back into his seat. So the video showing the car accelerating so quickly, getting up onto the sidewalk, hitting the signs, hitting the concrete planter, and 0.65 seconds before he hit the planter, he still had his foot three-quarters of the way down to the floor. And then afterward, with the concrete planter embedded in his car, he goes back across all four lanes of traffic, still never tapping the brakes. That is some evidence of recklessness. And, you know, if the defendant has a medical issue that he wanted the, you know, he wants a grand jury to consider, that's his right at the appropriate time before the ultimate fact finder. But in this realm, we're talking about upholding an indictment. And the grand jury found a prima facie case. And the recklessness is self-evident based on the fact that, you know, a video of him driving down the sidewalk without tapping his brakes, without moving to correct himself, that is self-evident of recklessness.
Standard of review? Should the abuse of discretion standard be covering a de novo review? Or you've heard the question and the colloquy. Go ahead.
I heard those questions, and frankly, before they were asked just now, I hadn't considered that. I think that the abuse of discretion standard is workable. It always has worked. But in determining whether the trial court abused his discretion, I think the court does have to look at the evidence that had been presented to determine whether he abused his discretion, because it's not just, you know, the fact findings he made. It's what else was presented that he may have not have considered. So I think it's still an abuse of discretion standard, but the court has to consider all of the evidence that was presented to determine whether the trial judge abused his discretion. And here I think that's clear because of the evidence that was presented and the very low bar that that the state had at the grand jury stage.
Thank you, Ms. Leonard. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Just lastly, that I would agree with the state that because of the statements that the trial judge has made about his personal opinion about the state's evidence, I think it would be right to reassign it to a different judge.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement.